I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in cases from Maryland and North Carolina that raise questions about whether lawmakers should continue to be allowed to redraw political districts to favor their own party. Is it time for redistricting to be taken out of the hands of politicians? And will the High Court decide that now is the time for it to intervene in the gerrymandering mess that is rampant throughout the land? With the 2020 census and more redistricting right around the corner, what will the court decide about Maryland's 6th district, which was redrawn in 2011 to favor Democrats? Thomas Wolfe from the Brennan Center for Justice and the Baltimore Sun's Andy Green join me when Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us today. A conversation about gerrymandering. Yesterday, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in two cases, one from Maryland and the other from North Carolina. Here in Maryland, a group of Republican voters contend that the state's 6th congressional district was unfairly redrawn in 2011 to favor Democrats, and Democrats have admitted as much. Republicans used to make up about 47% of that district's registered voters. After redistricting, the 6th district was only about 33% Republican. That district is now represented by David Trone, who was elected last November. It is one of 7 districts in Maryland that is represented by a Democrat. Only one, the 1st district, which is represented by Congressman Andy Harris, is represented by a Republican. And I apologize for the noise you're hearing in the background. They are doing some renovations on our building here at WIPR. We had an agreement that they would be taking a lunch break at this hour, and we've got somebody on their way outside to see if they can take a little break so we won't have to listen to that for the next hour. Back to gerrymandering, the practice of manipulating district boundaries to give unfair political advantage to one party at the expense of the other parties has been part of the American political system since the founding of the Republic. It also enjoys wide bipartisan support among politicians who rely on it for job security and wide disapproval of voters. Thomas Wolfe was at the U.S. Supreme Court yesterday listening to oral arguments in the two gerrymandering cases. He joins me now from NPR in Washington, D.C. Mr. Wolfe is with the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice in New York. His work focuses on redistricting and the census. An experienced constitutional lawyer and strategist, he has argued several high-profile cases before the High Court. Mr. Wolfe, welcome, sir.
Thanks for having me on.
And listeners, if you'd like to weigh in or if you have a question for Tom Wolfe, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. To drop us a tweet, it's @MiddayWIPR. Maybe we can get some of the workmen outside who are banging up the building to call into the show instead of making so much noise. So, Tom Wolfe, what happened yesterday? You were in the courtroom. It was about 2 hours of testimony in the case regarding Maryland, I guess, or was the 2 hours of testimony in both cases, North Carolina and Maryland?
It was in both cases. And basically what we saw going on, in my view of things, is that we saw a court in problem-solving mode. Does that mean that they are ultimately going to solve the problem of gerrymandering? I think that remains to be seen, as it always remains to be seen at arguments, since there's never a ruling handed down right there. But it seemed like the justices up and down the line were really concerned about piecing through the most difficult aspects of this question and really taking it seriously.
I mean, do you, as you read the tea leaves, I mean, it's a long-standing practice of people, you know, basing predictions or maybe speculating a little bit about how the court will ultimately rule based on the questions that various justices pose to the attorneys on both sides. Did you come away with a feeling one way or the other?
Well, I'm always cautiously optimistic about the prospects of the court finally doing something here. And here are a few data points that, in my mind, suggest that the court, at the very least, is taking this problem seriously. The folks that are defending the gerrymanderers in Maryland, that's the Office of the Attorney General, and in North Carolina, that's Paul Clement from the law firm Kirkland & Ellis, filed very large briefs that spent most of the time talking about sideshow issues, things like the history, or things like whether proportional representation was at issue here, or whether there were neutral excuses for why the Maryland's map ended up looking the way it did. For the most part, the justices, and here we're talking both on the right and the left, for instance, Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kavanaugh, came in very early to shut a lot of that talk down, particularly about the history and the justifications. That, to me, suggests that what the court was trying to do was to get all these sideshow issues off the table so that they can really piece through the big constitutional question here, which isn't, is partisan gerrymandering unconstitutional? Because the court has said that consistently for decades. The question here is much narrower. It's, is there a legal standard out there that will allow the court to knock down the worst cases of partisan gerrymandering, but not get the court involved in too many cases? And that's something that they were clearly tossing back and forth over the whole morning, whether it's in the North Carolina case or the Maryland case.
Because the court has considered gerrymandering cases in the past, and they've punted, right? I mean, they have basically, one of the key elements here is they've got to figure out whether or not this is in the purview of the courts, or should they keep it in the purview of legislatures like that in North Carolina or in Maryland to draw congressional lines. I mean, that's a basic philosophical question. Who should be responsible for divvying up states for congressional districts?
Exactly right. Now, these kinds of cases date back to the mid-80s, and each time the court's had an opportunity to do something, it's either directly punted or done something that was the equivalent of punting. So when they handled it in the 80s, they set a standard, but it was so high it was impossible for anyone to meet. A consistent through line, there are actually two. One is that whether justices are appointed by Republican presidents or Democratic presidents, there's been broad agreement that some amount of excessive partisan involvement in politics is unconstitutional. So we're really dealing with this smaller question, although it's a meaty one and a serious one, of if we set a rule, how do we set it in such a way that we don't end up with too many cases? Now, the court has long had to consider this other issue that you raised, because if the court decides to do nothing, as it has up until this point, it ends up putting the responsibility for redistricting entirely in the hands of legislators. And what's happened this decade is that those legislators have taken the absence of a rule from the Supreme Court as a green light to manipulate the districts. And the biggest example of that is North Carolina, where one of the two politicians who was in charge of the map drawing process stood up in a public hearing that's now been memorialized on YouTube and said, we had a racial gerrymander. We used that to get 10 Republican seats and 3 Democratic seats. The Supreme Court said racial gerrymandering is unconstitutional. Fine. If we have to redraw the map, we want the same 10 seats that we got from our racial gerrymander, and we're going to do it through a partisan gerrymander because the Supreme Court's never said that that is unconstitutional. That's kind of a slap in the face to the court, and I think the justices should be and are sensitive to that, those optics around these cases.
And here in Maryland, Martin O'Malley, who was the governor when the last census was conducted, oversaw the redistricting the last time it was done, and he was also very upfront in testimony. He said, yeah, we did this for political reasons. I mean, the two cases are similar in a lot of ways. Paul Clement, who, as you mentioned, was representing the Republicans in the North Carolina case, basically argued that it's perfectly acceptable for lawmakers to say that they're drawing districts for partisan reasons. Lawmakers are partisan. That's why they belong to particular political parties. Did the Maryland team make that same argument in Maryland as well?
Maryland actually took a much softer stance than Paul Clement did. Their position was not to try to do what Clement was trying to do, which was to get the court to say universally, categorically, for all time, these partisan gerrymandering cases can never be heard by courts again. Maryland was saying something much softer, which was there may be a standard, but whatever the plaintiffs in the Maryland case are putting on the table is not that. And as a result, they were kind of on their back foot the whole time because the justices asked the natural follow-up questions. Well, if you're not willing to say that these claims can never be heard by courts, what's the rule? And they didn't want to give the rule because if they did, it might sink them if the case ends up back in front of the trial court. So they were kind of stuck. They were caught between a rock and a hard place. And as a result, I think that they were not able to mount a particularly robust defense of what's going on in Maryland.
No one basically argues that the gerrymandering in both of these states, North Carolina and Maryland, is extreme. I mean, everybody seems to concede that point, at least. But how do the cases differ? Why did the two of them end up being paired like this?
Yeah, to take your second question first, the reason why they got paired together was basically just the action of time and the court's calendar. They were set up in a way that allowed them both to end up in front of the court at the same time. Justice Breyer, you know, kind of stepping back, has before in last term's argument suggested that given that there are all these theories on the table, maybe it would be best to just have everyone in front of the court at the same time and talk it out. And so this provided that opportunity. Now, I would like to emphasize the extent to which these cases are similar, because there is a strong possibility here that the court could strike down both maps, both North Carolina and Maryland. And the reason is, as you put it, is that the facts are tremendously extreme. In both cases, we have key lawmakers saying openly, we are trying to get every single seat we possibly can and prevent voters from getting the folks that get elected out of those seats if they're unhappy with them. And they actually succeeded in doing it. Democrats in Maryland could have had a 5-3 map that would have given fuller representation to black communities in Maryland, and they rejected that. They could have stuck with their 6-2 map, and they rejected that too. They wanted all the seats they could get, so they went 7-1. North Carolina, same way. They actually said on the record, if we could get 11 seats, we would. We just couldn't figure out how to do it. Now, how are the cases different? They're mainly different in terms of the legal theories, in the sense that each of the different groups of plaintiffs have a different idea about why what happened in their states violates the Constitution. In Maryland, they're arguing that it's basically like workplace retaliation, which is not allowed under the First Amendment. If someone disadvantages you because of your political views, that's a constitutional problem. Plaintiffs in North Carolina say, well, you know, this is sort of like a version of treating people differently, so it's kind of an equal protection claim under the 14th Amendment, and that it's like vote dilution, which we see in things like Voting Rights Act cases where one party sets about to undercut the other party's ability to elect their candidates of choice. But ultimately, all these things sort of boil down to the same thing. There needs to be a bad intent behind the map, a bad effect as a result of the map, and no real justification for why things turned out the way they did. So there's a little bit of forest and trees here. I think the forest is that they're both extreme. A number of these theories can take both of them out, and now it's really up to the court to figure out which solution is best.
I guess in Maryland they were invoking the First Amendment, right? That right. You know, political retaliation is forbidden under the First Amendment. In North Carolina, took a slightly different tack, but in terms of how they're different from other cases that the court has heard, one of the differences that you've pointed out in some of the things you've written about this is that the Democratic Party is actually in one of the cases in North Carolina. In Maryland here, there were several Republican voters, individuals, who said that their constitutional rights had been infringed upon because of the redistricting of District 6. And we should remind folks that in 1992, a Republican named Roscoe Bartlett was elected to that seat, and he held it for quite a long time. And then when it was redistricted, he held it until 2012. When it was redistricted in 2011, he lost that seat to a Democrat, John Delaney. Mr. Delaney has since left Congress to run for president. That seat is now held by another Democrat, David Trone. So it's clear that it was a Republican seat for a long time, and then it became a Democratic seat. But the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, are not actually litigants in this action now. But in North Carolina, the party is. Does that matter one way or the other?
Going into the argument, I thought that it might. And the reason, the deeper reason why having the Democratic Party in the mix is sort of twofold. One is that in the past, when the justices looked at these claims, they thought, well, maybe what you have individual voters saying is actually what they want is for their party to do better. And they shouldn't bring those claims. The party should bring those claims. The other reason is that Justice Kagan, in last term's Wisconsin case, laid out a theory that three other justices signed on to, under which a party could bring a claim and attack a whole state's map. And so the inclusion of the party in one of the North Carolina cases left that opportunity open. What was sort of interesting in the argument was that even Justice Kagan herself didn't raise that.
And of course, Maryland's 6th District, if it is, if this particular drawing of those lines is overturned, it's going to be complicated to figure out how to change the 6th District without changing other districts. We have an email from Michael, who lives in Chestertown, Maryland. That's in the 1st District. And he said, District 1 is just as bad. Mr. O'Malley gerrymandered conservative Harford County into our historic Eastern Shore District to make up for the over-the-top gerrymandering in District 6. So on the shore, we've had Democratic and moderate Republican congressmen like Wayne Gilchrist for decades, but we've ended up with a hard-right Tea Party, so-called Freedom Caucus Republican Andy Harris, who's a physician who's fought to kill Obamacare. So much for choice for District 1 voters. How about redistricting District 1 and allowing us a fair chance to oust the extremists, Mr. Harris, in the view of Michael from Chestertown? I mean, if the practical effect of this, Tom Wolfe, I mean, if these maps are ordered to be redrawn, this could change not just the particular districts at issue, but literally the whole state in both instances.
It depends on how the court rules. I think that the best way to understand gerrymanders is at the statewide level instead of focusing on any one particular district, because at least when you have these extreme gerrymanders like we saw in Maryland and North Carolina, and I think the reader who sent in the email already has his thumb on this, is that folks aren't looking at districts in isolation. They're trying to figure out what to do to the whole map to get the biggest advantage they can. So individual districts may be the sites where they start going in and moving people around, but what they're really trying to do is manipulate the whole map. And it is exactly right that in order to flip a district that had been heavily Republican into a Democratic district, you have to start moving people out and putting them other places. If you want to make sure that those districts then don't flip to the other party, you have to shuffle people around all over the state to make sure that you can hold your advantages.
And the complexion of the court is different than it was last year. Justice Kennedy, of course, retired. Justice Kavanaugh has replaced him. How does that dynamic affect the likelihood of the justices, jumping into the fray and really deciding for the first time that this is something they want to insert themselves in?
Yeah, the interesting thing about the court shuffling is that for the last few decades, everyone had been focused on, well, what can we do to get Justice Kennedy's vote? Because it seems like he's the holdout. If we could get that fifth vote, everything changes. Over the course of last term's arguments, though, it seemed very clear to me that Chief Justice Roberts and also Justice Alito were concerned with a couple different kinds of problems, including the thought that one party could create a rule to redraw a map where the rule says clearly we want to advantage one party to the maximum extent possible and disadvantage the other party to the maximum extent possible. That's exactly what happened in North Carolina and Maryland. And so coming into the arguments, it seemed like they might be in play. Justice Kavanaugh had no prior record on these issues, and he was also a very active questioner. I wouldn't say that every question he asked suggested to me that he was going to rule for the plaintiffs, but he played a key role at a couple different points in the argument to really box the gerrymanderers in. And the one thing that really stands out to me, because it's similar to something that Justice Sotomayor did, was very early on in the argument in Maryland being made by the attorney who was there to protect the gerrymander, was to say, look, I'm not convinced by your main justification or excuse, depending on how you look at it, here that we had to redraw something to respect the I-270 corridor. You're just not going to get traction with us. Why don't you move on to something else? That knocked out the key part of their defense, and it suggests to me that he's been at least thinking hard and talking with his colleagues about the best way to manage these cases, to ask the questions that are most important.
There are other states who've been down this road before and are various places. You mentioned there were racial gerrymandering cases, and the court has said that that's not legal. There are places like Georgia and Virginia and Texas that have had racial gerrymandering cases, but you've got Wisconsin, you've got Michigan, you've got Ohio. So there'll be rulings sometime in June, we expect, for North Carolina and Maryland, but there could be a big effect on other places as well. And what would that affect? What would that look like?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And this is something that I noticed even when I was looking through Twitter to see folks' reactions to the news of the argument yesterday, where some folks, I think, have been disappointed by the notion that maybe what the court rules here ends up not having a huge sweep. I actually think that's the main reason why the court will do something, is if it thinks it can do something without taking in too much. And so what we're really hoping for and what we've been aiming for in our own advocacy with the court is to get the court to say extreme partisan gerrymanders, where one party takes control of the process, maxes out their seats, and locks them in for a whole decade, is unconstitutional. And here's how you figure out when that's happened. If they do that, there probably would only be a handful of maps this decade that could be challenged. Now, we're also running out of time on that front, but a few congressional maps and a few state legislative maps. What that means in next round is that when the maps get redrawn after the census in 2021, legislators aren't going to be able to max out their seats anymore, and we should see fewer of these cases. And the few that remain can be taken down. Now, what I often tell folks is to be very clear-eyed that the court ultimately is not going to issue a referendum on everything that's wrong with our map drawing processes. I think the best we can hope for is that they're going to take the worst abuses out of the system, which then puts the onus back on voters to pursue additional reforms to fix the other problems that we have.
Ahead of these arguments, the court received 43 amicus briefs. That seems like a lot to me as a non-lawyer. Is that normal? Is that more than usual? How do you read that number of amicus briefs that were filed in relation to the North Carolina and Maryland cases?
It's about typical and maybe actually a little bit on the low side for highly controversial, high-profile cases. In the travel ban case, for instance, they received far more briefs. But that volume is roughly typical of these big kind of hot-button political issues.
One of those briefs was written by you and your colleagues at the Brennan Center. Another was written by Governor Larry Hogan in conjunction with Arnold Schwarzenegger, the former Republican governor of California. One of the points that they make in their amicus brief is that the effect of this gerrymandering is to sort of drown out the voices of those who are moderates in both parties. In other words, because the districts are so heavily weighted towards one party or the other, the real election is in the primary. It's not in the general election. And the primaries tend to bring out people on both the left and the right who are in the extreme elements of both the left and the right. What do you think of that argument?
There's a related problem here, which I view as always ultimately an issue of representation. So our Constitution says that we should have legislatures that represent us, and that means that they look like us. They can kind of understand the debates that are going on in our households. And so if you have a state like North Carolina that's a swing state basically every year for any big statewide election, whether it's for governor or president, and you end up with a legislature that, a congressional delegation that's 10-3 year after year, you're clearly not getting legislators who represent you. It also has other problems, like because gerrymandering is very important, and any politician who tells you that it's not, you should be very distrustful of, because they pay a lot of money to these consultants to draw these maps, and if they didn't get some kind of benefit out of it, they wouldn't be spending the money. There's so much fighting now over the redistricting process that legislators come to hate each other. And so when it's time to actually do what they've been elected to do, which is create laws that serve our interests, they can't work together. It just feeds this really negative political environment, this intense partisanship. And, voters deserve better. Citizens and residents of these states deserve better. It's really time that the courts step in here, put some rules in place, and reform take care of the rest.
Tom Wolfe is counsel with the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University. Tom, thanks so much for your insight and for your time. I very much appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Quick break, and when we return, more on the Supreme Court and the 6th Congressional District, and a look behind the headlines of some of the other big stories of the week with Baltimore Sun editorial page editor Andy Green. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. We appreciate that. Stay with us. Welcome Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, the Poet Laureate of Maryland, Grace Cavalieri. She'll join me here in Studio A. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will review Small House, No Secrets. That's a musical at the Fells Point Corner Theater. So that's all coming up tomorrow on Midday. If you're just joining us today, we've been talking about the Supreme Court, which just yesterday heard arguments in two gerrymandering cases, one from Maryland, the other from North Carolina. Andy Green joins me now here in the studio. He's the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. Good to see you, sir.
Hi, Tom.
And if you'd like to join our conversation, listeners, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. You can tweet me at @TomHallWYPR. So, Andy, you are a scholar of redistricting. You've written a lot about this for the paper. The makeup of the court, the fact that Brett Kavanaugh has replaced Justice Kennedy, that's significant in a number of ways, isn't it?
Right. Well, as Tom Wolfe was saying, there was a lot of thought over the years that Anthony Kennedy was the swing vote. He was somebody who'd clearly indicated a willingness and an interest for the court to get involved in stopping gerrymandering, but for want of some kind of metric to use. And that's why a lot of people were very focused on a case out of Wisconsin, which had a particularly egregious gerrymander in its state legislative district. And the case there involved some novel theories, social science theories that essentially tried to create a mathematical framework to figure out wasted votes in the course of an election as an evidence of gerrymandering. But that case was sent back for lack of standing among the plaintiffs. It's not back before us now. So now we've got these two Maryland cases. We also have Brett Kavanaugh. And as Mr. Wolf said, nobody knows or at least had any idea before yesterday what Brett Kavanaugh thought about gerrymandering. So one thing that if you read the transcript, one thing that really comes through in the early part of this argument about Maryland is that Brett Kavanaugh is from Maryland. Right. As Mr. Wolf said, he cut them off on this idea that we had to respect the I-270 corridor. He went on and on for quite a bit about Maryland's geography and what they're including and not including.
He knows exactly what the I-270 corridor
yes.
is.
He lives in Montgomery County. He's at ground zero for this particular gerrymander. When they got into a conversation about the referendum Maryland had back in 2012, when some petitioners tried to challenge these maps, and they were put before the voters, and the voters actually approved the maps through this referendum. There was some questioning about whether the ballot language was sufficient for people to understand what they were voting on. The ballot language said essentially, do you approve of the legislature redrawing these maps pursuant to the census, which, absent any other information, like, say, a picture of the map or something like that, people would say, well, sure, of course, we should do that. And so there was some conversation in the court about whether that was really an appropriate description so that you could make any hay out of the fact that voters approved this. Brett Kavanaugh probably voted in that election. I mean, I haven't looked at his records, but presumably he did. So this is somebody who has a very close understanding of the specifics of this situation. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Governor Hogan, interestingly, is in the opposite camp from his attorney general, who had to argue in defense of the gerrymander. Governor Hogan, one of the leading advocates for creating commissions, and he had with him yesterday at the court. They were in the courtroom during the testimony. Arnold Schwarzenegger, who's a very high profile guy, and whose state, California, does in fact do the districts now by a commission, and that's something that Mr. Hogan wants to have happen here. He's appointed a commission. Tell us where things stand, because as I understand it, this commission that Mr. Hogan has charged with coming up with a new district had a deadline of March 7th, a couple weeks ago, to come up with something for the 2020 election. Did they meet that deadline, and how does that play into what the court might do?
Well, this was an interesting thing, because a district court last fall said Maryland's maps are illegal, you can't use them. And so the state had a choice of two different things it could do, and it did both of them, which is it could go and just redraw the map and move forward with that, which is the avenue that Governor Hogan is taking. He appointed a group of people. They're working on that. or the state could appeal to the Supreme Court, which Brian Frosch, the attorney general, did. Now, of course, the interesting thing is that Brian Frosch is not trying to defend gerrymandering or to say that the courts shouldn't have a role here. He's in a very awkward, little bit of a wishy-washy position with respect to that. Now, the problem that Governor Hogan faces is whatever he comes up with this commission is, A, possibly going to be trumped by whatever the Supreme Court does. You know, if the Supreme Court overturns this district court decision, then his effort goes up in a poof of smoke. And two, he has to get the legislature to approve of whatever he's doing. And no amount of shaming seems to get the democratic powers that be in the legislature to accept the idea that we should reform Maryland's redistricting rules in absence of other states doing the same thing. They keep saying we don't want to.
Right now, they just say they don't want to do it unilaterally.
Yes, they don't want to unilaterally.
Delaware and New Jersey and Pennsylvania and Virginia.
Right.
If they all change their formulas for districts, Maryland will too. Governor Hogan, I think, has a very winning political issue in that regard.
So interestingly, you mentioned California. Some members of the California Redistricting Commission came to Annapolis a few weeks ago to testify, and they stopped by the Sun on their way. And so we spent an hour with these three people, one of them a Republican, one a Democrat, one an independent. And it was funny, they had us try to guess midway through the meeting who was who, which was not always easy, honestly. And so they described the process that they went through in California. They, thousands and thousands of people, ordinary folks, applied to be on this commission. They had a series, they had to write essays, they had a series of interviews, and finally this gets winnowed down to a group of people who then spent months and months going all over this very large, very diverse state, talking to people, getting input on what the maps should be. And so they started from a blank canvas. They had and used no information about where any incumbents live, any information about party registration or voting patterns. And they just went by people arguing, you know, my community should be this. I live in this area, but we have something in common with these people over here. We'd like to be together, or we've been lumped with this community in the past. We should be separate for these reasons. And they came up with a map that has survived and has, in fact, produced much more competitive elections. And they also think, in particular, in the state house, you may recall there was a period where California was considered to be ungovernable, that they kept being unable to pass budgets. This was all sort of in the Schwarzenegger era. And now that they have had elections under these new maps that were drawn by this commission, you know, anecdotally, there's a real sense that there is less partisan gridlock there, that there's a lot more willingness to cooperate and compromise in the legislature. And California has consequently been doing a lot better in terms of its self-governance in the last several years. So, you know, this is something that I think people would find very appealing if this became the norm everywhere.
I mean, the national polling is pretty clear that people really don't like the gridlock that is caused by gerrymandering.
Yeah.
But if a Republican representative, be it in Congress or a state legislature, has both Republicans, Democrats, and independents in her district, she's going to have to figure out solutions that appease everybody.
Right. And one thing the court needs to grapple with here is one of the things that was part of the discussion yesterday was, well, this is a political problem. Can't the political branch of government sort this out itself? Well, you know, won't there be pressure for reform so that this will take care of itself? Look, some states have already done this. Well, states like California that have direct referendum government have been much more able to do this because it's popular with the people. They're able to put an initiative on the ballot to do this without the legislature's action. Many other states, Maryland included, don't have that avenue available to us. We are totally dependent on the legislature being willing to take this up. And so for that reason, it might be very useful for the courts to set some kind of speed limit on this, so to speak, to say that, you know, if you go too far, you're going to get hammered and the courts may redraw the lines in ways that you won't like. But that may, I would hope, make the political leaders more willing to entertain the idea of the kind of reform that Governor Hogan is talking about or what they have in California, to say that, look, if we're running the risk that the courts are going to knock us down, maybe we ought to do it this way, because at least it's more predictable and we're not putting ourselves in the hands of unelected people who can do whatever they like.
Yeah, because the threat is hanging over them, this judicial threat. But then there are folks who make the argument that, look, political districts are a political function and mm-hmm. should be therefore decided by the political branch of government, the legislative branch, not the judiciary.
Yeah.
Or certainly, as you mentioned, unelected people who are appointed by a political person, you know, in this case, the governor and then perhaps the president of the Senate and the speaker of the House. Mm-hmm. What about that argument that, you know, this should be as flawed as it is, perhaps this should be in the hands of politicians rather than judges?
Yeah, I mean, that's an appealing argument in theory, but I would say our experience over the last few decades, when the art of gerrymandering has become much more sophisticated through use of, you know, computer mapping and all that sort of stuff, what we have seen is that people are not voting on this issue alone, right? That this is not something that people are going to the polls specifically to support a pro-gerrymandering or anti-gerrymandering candidate. This is not an issue that is turning elections.
Although the governor did mention it during the campaign.
He did,
we recall that he won handily. Yeah.
Yes, and his opponent, Ben Jealous, at one point promised, I'm going to try to make it 8-0. Although I don't think that was decisive in this particular case. You know, the point is that the political branches are not and have not taken care of this. They have so far not really suffered in Maryland or in a number of other states any particular ill consequences at the ballot box for having done this. And it's, of course, difficult for them to do so since they've stacked the deck in their favor. In theory, it is appealing, I think, to say this is a political problem that should be solved by politics, but it's not working.
Andy Green is the editorial page editor at the Baltimore Sun and a good friend of this program. We'll have more with Andy after a quick break. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. You can tweet us at @MiddayWIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, Baltimore Sun editorial page editor Andy Green joins me here in Studio A. We're talking about the Supreme Court. And Andy, let's talk about some of the other big stories of the week. Yet another delegate in the House of Delegates in the General Assembly has been called to task by his colleagues. Tell us about what's going on with Delegate Jay Gelisi.
Yeah, so the General Assembly's Ethics Committee investigated complaints about him and found reason to believe that he had fostered a hostile work environment, particularly toward female staffers. And they voted to reprimand him, which is a step below censure. So recall earlier this year, Delegate Lasanti from Harford County was censured for allegedly using a racial slur. This is one step below that. But still, it's a very big deal for the legislature to do this. It doesn't happen very often. The most recent time it had taken action against a member like this prior to the session was against former Delegate Dan Morheim over some questions about his involvement.
His relationship to a company that was doing business that and having to do with medical marijuana.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Or there was another one a few years before that with Senator Ulysses Curry from Prince George's County, who also had some potential conflicts that were undisclosed. So this is not something that happens often. But it's something that certainly should be taken very seriously when the legislature does, because they don't do it lightly.
You mentioned in Delegate Lasanti's case, it was a censure. In Delegate Gelisi's case, it's a reprimand. I mean, is the difference between those, Semantic? What is that?
I mean, yeah,
is Lasanti, you know, more persona non grata than
more? That's more or less what it amounts to. It's being slapped on the wrist harder. You know, it's depending on how you look at it. You know, this is all, of course, short of expulsion, which is generally for a much bigger deal, like possible criminal action. So, you know, within the universe of things, it's still serious, and it's a black mark to have.
Of course, last year we had Nathaniel Oakes, who was in fact, kicked out when he was convicted of a felony crime.
He resigned.
Yeah,
but yeah.
Right.
But yes, it should also say that Delegate Gelisi denies this, says this is all, these are trumped up charges. So,
and it's hard to say exactly what Delegate Lasanti says about it, because that story has changed a little bit, although everybody and their grandmother was calling for her to resign. She seems to have resisted that, and she's no longer on any committees. And,
yes, which is not good for the people of her district, for certain.
Yeah. Her ability to represent them in an aggressive way is certainly compromised. Mayor Pugh, Catherine Pugh, who we, as far as we know, is still at Johns Hopkins Hospital being treated for pneumonia, and we wish her the best and a quick and speedy recovery. Pneumonia is a serious condition, and let's hope that she's feeling better. When she is feeling better and she comes back, there are still a number of questions swirling around her involvement with the University of Maryland Medical System Board.
Yes. So in case you've missed this, Catherine Pugh had been on the University of Maryland Medical System Board since 2001. Sometime around 2010 or so, she got into conversation with people there about these children's books that she was writing called Healthy Holly. It's about a young girl who learns about exercise and healthy eating and other sort of good things that certainly are issues that Mayor Pugh is interested in. She is a fitness nut, I think you could fairly say.
Yep.
So the University of Maryland Medical System agreed to buy bulk copies of these books over the course of the years, 5 separate orders for 20,000 books each, $100,000 a pop. She said eventually at some point admitted that her profit on these was $20,000 per order for a cumulative total of $100,000. She has given back the money from the last order of them because the book had not yet been written. So there are a lot of questions about this. You know, my colleagues on the news side at The Sun went to a great deal of effort to try to figure out what the heck happened to these books. Supposedly, they were going to be donated to schools and daycare centers. The city schools said they got some of them back around 2011-ish, 2011 to 2013. They have 8,700 of them sitting in a warehouse somewhere, undistributed. The mayor at one point said, oh, we sent 21,000 of them to the city schools. The city schools can't confirm or deny that. They don't know. And so some of my colleagues spent several days calling around to different, you know, the archdiocese schools, private schools, suburban schools, daycare centers, big daycare providers, all over.
Nobody can seem to find any of these, or very many of them.
Yeah, exactly. So by our accounting, at least some 50,000 copies of these books are unaccounted for. So that's a big question. You know, did UMMS do anything whatsoever to confirm where these books were going, to make sure they were achieving the purpose that they supposedly were going for? Does Mayor Pugh have any documentation of this, of where they've gone, when they were printed, how many were printed, all that sort of thing? These are some big questions that are hanging over it.
Yeah, and speaking of books, there's a guy named James Cabezas who has just published a memoir about his time as an investigator in cases like this. He has filed some sort of document with prosecutors, making analogies between what's going on with Mayor Pugh and what had gone on with Sheila Dixon, for example,
or Dallas Dance
in Baltimore County. He's had a career investigating these kinds of crimes.
He's a civilian, though. He's made sort of a citizen's complaint to say, hey, I request that you look into this. We also called for the state prosecutor and or the U.S. Attorney's Office to look into this, because there are a lot of questions about this that an audit, which is what the legislature is perhaps going to be mandating any second now,
Because there are two bills, one in the House and one in the Senate, to disallow this in the future, and I'll take care of the mess as it is. Yeah.
So there are a lot of questions about this that an audit is not really going to cover. You know, to do an analogy to the Sheila Dixon scandal, an audit would have told you that they had poor controls over the gift cards they got as part of the mayor's holly trolley Christmas. An investigation by law enforcement tells you, and some of them wound up in Mayor Dixon's pocket. So, you know, we don't know enough to say that anything like that is happening here whatsoever. And certainly, you know, with the Dallas Dance analogy, he did in fact go to jail for perjury for failing to disclose outside income on his financial disclosure forms. We know that Mayor Pugh did not mention the Healthy Holly income on her disclosure forms when she was in the Senate.
She has since amended.
But the big difference here is that the investigation turned up incontrovertible evidence that Dallas Dance was intentionally trying to conceal that income. You know, there were documentation, there were emails, there were text messages. So we at this point don't have anything like that related to Mayor Pugh. For all we know, this could have just been an oversight. So we just don't have that evidence right now. So and maybe there is none. I mean, we have no idea. One way or the other.
And in other news, there is some good news for the city of Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Meredith Cohn, one of your colleagues on the news side of the Sun, had a piece yesterday about the sort of real estate year. This is a scorecard that was released yesterday morning by the Downtown Partnership, talking about things like vacancies for office mm-hmm. space and retail and apartments and that kind of stuff. And 2018 wasn't super duper, but it sure wasn't bad.
No, the downtown area in particular has been very strong over the course of the last several years, particularly in terms of residential growth. You know, has been the fastest growing census tract in the city over the course of the last several years. It's been a real bright spot population-wise. Lots of apartment conversions going on down there. You've, of course, got a new luxury apartment tower right across Light Street from the Inner Harbor with rents that are simply astronomical for some of their apartments. So there's a lot of activity going on down there, which is, you know, perpetually, you know, my colleague Dan Rodericks writes about this a lot, about how there's bad news and good news happening right next to each other in the city, and we can never quite get going in one direction or the other. But so again, it's good reminder that not everything is going badly.
And another piece of good news is that revenues are way up for the city of Baltimore, mm-hmm. and officials have proposed a new budget, about $2.9 billion. There is a surplus that they weren't kind of expecting, and they're going to spend some of that on stuff like demolishing vacant houses and IT, and the school system gets a little bump. So there's a little bit more money to spread around. The mayor has talked about reducing the property tax as well.
Right.
What do you make of all that?
Yeah, so she would bring the property tax for homeowners, the effective property tax, below $2 per hundred in assessed value for the first time in, I think, about 50 years. You know, it's obviously still a lot higher than it is in the suburbs, but that's a kind of an important symbolic level to get below and a confirmation of the direction things are going. You know, it's certainly good news to have, you know, some extra money. The city schools clearly need it, given the uncertainty surrounding what's going on with state funding pursuant to the Kerwin Commission. You know, that's still a little up in the air amid this legislative session. As we've documented, the city's efforts to reduce the stock of vacant housing has been not terribly successful over the years. It's as soon as they bring one down, more vacants come up. So that's certainly, you know, another good sign. But there's a lot of concern about whether the economy is going to stay this strong in the long term. So I wouldn't get too confident.
When it comes to the economics, you know, variables abound. Yes. Well, Andy, always good to see you, sir. Thank you, and look forward to the next time.
Thanks, Tom.
Andy Green is the editorial page editor of the Baltimore Sun. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, The Maryland Poet Laureate Grace Cavalieri joins me, plus theater critic Jaywin Russick will have a review of Small House, No Secrets. That's a musical at the Fells Point Corner Theater. So I hope you can join us tomorrow on Midday. Lunch today was provided by Dangerously Delicious Pies. They've got locations at 2839 O'Donnell Street, that's on the square in Canton, and at 810 West 36th Street in Hamden. Their menu includes a large variety of homemade sweet and savory pies and quiches. More information on the web at dangerouspiesvault.com. I'm Tom Hall. Here and Now is coming up at the top of the hour after the news from NPR. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.